ready to get the male to pursue her so feverishly that he loses control, and a touch of the dangerous. Danger is surprisingly seductive. To get the male to pursue you is relatively simple. A highly sexual presence will do this quite well. But you must not resemble a courtesan or whore, whom the male may pursue only to quickly lose interest in her. Instead, you are slightly elusive and distant, a fantasy come to life. During the Renaissance, the great sirens, such as Tullia d'Aragona, would act and look like Grecian goddesses, the fantasy of the day. Today, you might model yourself on a film goddess, anything that seems larger than life, even awe-inspiring. These qualities will make a man chase you vehemently, and the more he chases, the more he will feel he is acting on his own initiative. This is an excellent way of disguising how deeply you are manipulating him. The notion of danger, challenge, sometimes death might seem outdated, but danger is critical in seduction. It adds emotional spice and is particularly appealing to men today who are normally so rational and repressed. Danger is present in the original myth of the siren. In Homer's Odyssey, the hero Odysseus must sail by the rocks where the sirens, strange female creatures, sing and beckon sailors to their destruction. They sing of the glories of the past, of a world like childhood, without responsibilities, a world of pure pleasure. Their voices are like water, liquid and inviting. Sailors would leap into the water to join them and drown. Or, distracted and entranced, they would steer their ship into the rocks. To protect his sailors from the sirens, Odysseus has their ears filled with wax. He himself is tied to the mast, so he can both hear the sirens and live to tell of it. A strange desire, since the thrill of the sirens is giving in to the temptation to follow them. Just as the ancient sailors had to row and steer, ignoring all distractions, a man today must work and follow a straight path in life. The call of something dangerous, emotional, unknown, is all the more powerful because it is so forbidden. Think of the victims of the great sirens of history. Paris causes a war for the sake of Helen of Troy. Caesar risks an empire, and Antony loses his power and his life for Cleopatra. Napoleon becomes a laughingstock over Josephine. DiMaggio never gets over Marilyn, and Arthur Miller can't write for years. A man is often ruined by a siren, yet cannot tear himself away. Many powerful men have a masochistic streak. An element of danger is easy to hint at and will enhance your other siren characteristics. The touch of madness in Marilyn, for example, that pulled men in. Sirens are often fantastically irrational, which is immensely attractive to men who are oppressed by their own reasonableness. An element of fear is also critical. Keeping a man at a proper distance creates respect, so that he doesn't get close enough to see through you or notice your weaker qualities. Create such fear by suddenly changing your moods, keeping the man off balance, occasionally intimidating him with capricious behavior. The most important element for an aspiring siren is always the physical, the siren's main instrument of power. Physical qualities, a scent, a heightened femininity evoked through makeup or through elaborate or seductive clothing, act all the more powerfully on men because they have no meaning. In their immediacy, they bypass rational processes, having the same effect that a decoy has on an animal, or the movement of a cape on a bull. The proper siren appearance is often confused with physical beauty, particularly the face. But a beautiful face does not a siren make. Instead, it creates too much distance and coldness. Neither Cleopatra nor Marilyn Monroe, the two greatest sirens in history, were known for their beautiful faces. Although a smile and an inviting look are infinitely seductive, they must never dominate your appearance. They are too obvious and direct. The siren must stimulate a generalized desire, and the best way to do this is by creating an overall impression that is both distracting and alluring. It is not one particular trait, but a combination of qualities. The voice. Clearly a critical quality, as the legend indicates, the siren's voice has an immediate animal presence with incredible suggestive power. Perhaps that power is regressive, recalling the ability of the mother's voice to calm or excite her child even before the child understood what she was saying. The siren must have an insinuating voice that hints at the erotic more often subliminally than overtly. Almost everyone who met Cleopatra commented on her delightful, sweet-sounding voice, which had a mesmerizing quality. The Empress Josephine, one of the great seductresses of the late 18th century, had a languorous voice that men found exotic and suggestive of her Creole origins. Marilyn Monroe was born with her breathy, childlike voice, but she learned to lower it, to make it truly seductive. Lauren Bacall's voice is naturally low. Its seductive power comes from its slow, suggestive delivery. The siren never speaks quickly, aggressively, or at a high pitch. Her voice is calm and unhurried, as if she had never quite woken up or left her bed. Body and adornment. If the voice must lull, the body and its adornment must dazzle. It is with her clothes that the siren aims to create the goddess effect that Baudelaire described in his essay In Praise of Makeup. Woman is well within her rights, and indeed she is accomplishing a kind of duty in striving to appear magical and supernatural. She must astonish and bewitch. An idol, she must adorn herself with gold in order to be adored. She must borrow from all of the arts in order to raise herself above nature, the better to subjugate hearts and stir souls. A siren who was a genius of clothes and adornment was Pauline Bonaparte, sister of Napoleon. Pauline consciously strove for a goddess effect, fashioning hair, makeup, and clothes to evoke the look and air of Venus, the goddess of love. No one in history could boast a more extensive and elaborate wardrobe. Pauline's entrance at a ball in 1798 created an astounding effect. She asked the hostess, Madame Permont, if she could dress at her house, so no one would see her clothes as she came in. When she came down the stairs, everyone stopped dead in stunned silence. She wore the headdress of a bacchante. Clusters of gold grapes interlaced in her hair, which was done up in the Greek style. Her Greek tunic, with its gold-embroidered hem, showed off her goddess-like figure. Below her breasts was a girdle of burnished gold held by a magnificent jewel. "No words can convey the loveliness of her appearance," wrote the Duchess d'Abrantes. The very room grew brighter as she entered. The whole ensemble was so harmonious that her appearance was greeted with a buzz of admiration, which continued with utter disregard of all the other women. The key, everything, must dazzle, but also be harmonious, so that no single ornament draws attention. Your presence must be charged, larger than life, a fantasy come true. Ornament is used to cast a spell and distract. The siren can also use clothing to hint at the sexual, at times overtly, but more often by suggesting it rather than screaming it. That would make you seem manipulative. Related to this is the notion of selective disclosure, the revealing of only a part of the body, but a part that will excite and stir the imagination. In the late 16th century, Marguerite de Valois, the infamous daughter of Queen Catherine de Médicis of France, was one of the first women ever to incorporate décolletage in her wardrobe, simply because she had the most beautiful breasts in the realm. For Josephine Bonaparte, it was her arms, which she carefully always left bare. Movement and demeanor. In the 5th century BC, King Guo Jian chose the Chinese siren Xi Shi from among all the women of his realm to seduce and destroy his rival Fu Chai, King of Wu. For this purpose, he had the young woman instructed in the arts of seduction. Most important of these was movement, how to move gracefully and suggestively. Xi Shi learned to give the impression of floating across the floor in her court robes. When she was finally unleashed on Fu Chai, he quickly fell under her spell. She walked and moved like no one he had ever seen. He became obsessed with her tremulous presence, her manner, and nonchalant air. Fu Chai fell so deeply in love that he let his kingdom fall to pieces, allowing Guo Jian to march in and conquer it without a fight. The siren moves gracefully and unhurriedly. The proper gestures, movement, and demeanor for a siren are like the proper voice. They hint at something exciting, stirring desire without being obvious. Your air must be languorous, as if you had all the time in the world for love and pleasure. Your gestures must have a certain ambiguity, suggesting something both innocent and erotic. Anything that cannot immediately be understood is supremely seductive, and all the more so if it permeates your manner. Dangers. No matter how enlightened the age, no woman can maintain the image of being devoted to pleasure completely comfortably. And no matter how hard she tries to distance herself from it, the taint of being easy always follows the siren. Cleopatra was hated in Rome as the Egyptian whore. That hatred eventually led to her downfall, as Octavius and the Roman army sought to extirpate the stain on Roman manhood that she came to represent. Even so, men are often forgiving when it comes to the siren's reputation. But danger often lies in the envy she stirs up among other women. Much of Rome's hatred for Cleopatra originated in the resentment she provoked among the city's stern matrons. By playing up her innocence, by making herself seem the victim of male desire, the siren can somewhat blunt the effects of feminine envy. But on the whole, there is little she can do. Her power comes from her effect on men, and she must learn to accept or ignore the envy of other women. Finally, the intense attention that the siren attracts can prove irritating and worse. Sometimes she will pine for relief from it. Sometimes, too, she will want to attract an attention that is not sexual. Also, unfortunately, physical beauty fades, although the siren effect depends not on a beautiful face but on an overall impression. Past a certain age, that impression gets hard to project. Both of these factors contributed to the suicide of Marilyn Monroe. It takes a genius on the level of Madame de Pompadour, the siren mistress of King Louis XV, to make the transition into the role of the spirited older woman who continues to seduce with her non-physical charms. Cleopatra had such an intellect, and had she lived long enough, she would have remained a potent seductress for many years. The siren must prepare for age by paying attention early on to the more psychological, less physical forms of coquetry that can continue to bring her power once her beauty starts to fade. In conclusion, here are some further reflections on
The Siren.
From Homer's The Odyssey, Book 12. In the meantime, our good ship, with that perfect wind to drive her, fast approached the Siren's isle. But now the breeze dropped, some power lulled the waves, and a breathless calm set in. Rising from their seats, my men drew in the sail and threw it into the hold, then sat down at the oars and churned the water white with their blades of polished pine. Meanwhile, I took a large round of wax, cut it up small with my sword, and kneaded the pieces with all the strength of my fingers. The wax soon yielded to my vigorous treatment and grew warm, for I had the rays of my lord the sun to help me. I took each of my men in turn and plugged their ears with it. They then made me a prisoner on my ship by binding me hand and foot, standing me up by the step of the mast, and tying the rope's ends to the mast itself. This done, they sat down once more and struck the gray water with their oars. We made good progress and had just come within call of the shore when the Sirens became aware that a ship was swiftly bearing down upon them, and broke into their liquid song. "Draw near," they sang, "illustrious Odysseus, flower of Achaean chivalry, and bring your ship to rest, so that you may hear our voices. No seaman ever sailed his black ship past this spot without listening to the sweet tones that flow from our lips." The lovely voices came to me across the water, and my heart was filled with such a longing to listen that with nod and frown I signed to my men to set me free. From Plutarch's Makers of Rome. The charm of Cleopatra's presence was irresistible, and there was an attraction in her person and talk, together with a peculiar force of character, which pervaded her every word and action, and laid all who associated with her under its spell. It was a delight merely to hear the sound of her voice, with which, like an instrument of many strings, she could pass from one language to another. From Jean Baudrillard's De la Séduction. The immediate attraction of a song, a voice, or scent. The attraction of the panther with his perfumed scent. According to the ancients, the panther is the only animal who emits a perfumed odor. It uses this scent to draw and capture its victims. But what is it that seduces in a scent? What is it in the song of the sirens that seduces us, or in the beauty of a face, in the depths of an abyss? Seduction lies in the annulment of signs and their meaning, in pure appearance. The eyes that seduce have no meaning, they end in the gaze, as the face with makeup ends in only pure appearance. The scent of the panther is also a meaningless message, and behind the message, the panther is invisible, as is the woman beneath her makeup. The sirens, too, remained unseen. The enchantment lies in what is hidden. From Ovid's Cures for Love. We're dazzled by feminine adornment, by the surface, all gold and jewels, so little of what we observe is the girl herself. And where, you may ask, amid such plenty can our object of passion be found? The eyes deceived by love's smart camouflage. From The Greek Myths by Robert Graves. He was herding his cattle on Mount Gargarus, the highest peak of Ida, when Hermes, accompanied by Hera, Athena, and Aphrodite, delivered the golden apple and Zeus's message. "Paris, since you are as handsome as you are wise in affairs of the heart, Zeus commands you to judge which of these goddesses is the fairest." "So be it," sighed Paris. "But first, I beg the losers not to be vexed with me. I am only a human being, liable to make the stupidest mistakes. The goddesses all agreed to abide by his decision. Will it be enough to judge them as they are? Paris asked Hermes. Or should they be naked? The rules of the contest are for you to decide, Hermes answered with a discreet smile. In that case, will they kindly disrobe? Hermes told the goddesses to do so, and politely turned his back. Aphrodite was soon ready, but Athena insisted that she should remove the famous magic girdle, which gave her an unfair advantage by making everyone fall in love with the wearer. Very well, said Aphrodite spitefully. I will, on condition that you remove your helmet. You look hideous without it. Now, if you please, I must judge you one at a time, announced Paris. Come here, divine Hera. Will you other two goddesses be good enough to leave us for a while? Examine me conscientiously, said Hera, turning slowly around and displaying her magnificent figure. And remember that if you judge me the fairest, I will make you lord of all Asia and the richest man alive. I am not to be bribed, my lady. Very well, thank you. Now I have seen all that I need to see. Come, divine Athena. Here I am, said Athena, striding purposefully forward. Listen, Paris. If you have enough common sense to award me the prize, I will make you victorious in all your battles, as well as the handsomest and wisest man in the world. I am a humble herdsman, not a soldier, said Paris. But I promise to consider fairly your claim to the apple. Now you are at liberty to put on your clothes and helmet again. Is Aphrodite ready? Aphrodite sidled up to him, and Paris blushed because she came so close that they were almost touching. Look carefully, please. Pass nothing over. By the way, as soon as I saw you, I said to myself, upon my word, there goes the handsomest young man in Phrygia. Why does he waste himself here in the wilderness, herding stupid cattle? Well, why do you, Paris? Why not move into a city and lead a civilized life? What have you to lose by marrying someone like Helen of Sparta, who is as beautiful as I am and no less passionate? I suggest now that you tour Greece with my son Eros as your guide. Once you reach Sparta, he and I will see that Helen falls head over heels in love with you. Would you swear to that? Paris asked excitedly. Aphrodite uttered a solemn oath, and Paris, without a second thought, awarded her the golden apple. From Gottfried von Strasburg's Tristan. To whom can I compare the lovely girl, so blessed by fortune, if not to the sirens, who with their lodestone draw the ships towards them? Thus, I imagine, did Isolde attract many thoughts and hearts that deemed themselves safe from love's disquietude. And indeed, these two, anchorless ships and stray thoughts provide a good comparison. They are both so seldom on a straight course, lie so often in unsure havens, pitching and tossing and heaving to and fro. Just so, in the same way, do aimless desire and random love-longing drift like an anchorless ship. This charming young princess, discreet and courteous Isolde, drew thoughts from the hearts that enshrined them as a lodestone draws in ships to the sound of the siren song. She sang openly and secretly, in through ears and eyes to where many a heart was stirred. The song which she sang openly in this and other places was her own sweet singing and soft sounding of strings that echoed for all to hear through the kingdom of the ears deep down into the heart. But her secret song was her wondrous beauty that stole with its rapturous music, hidden and unseen through the windows of the eyes, into many noble hearts and smoothed on the magic which took thoughts prisoner suddenly, and taking them, fettered them with desire. From Lives of the Courtesans by Lynn Lawner. Falling in love with statues and paintings, even making love to them, is an ancient fantasy, one of which the Renaissance was keenly aware. Giorgio Vasari, writing in the introductory section of The Lives about art in antiquity, tells how men violated the laws, going into the temples at night and making love with statues of Venus. In the morning, priests would enter the sanctuaries to find stains on the marble figures. The Rake. A woman never quite feels desired and appreciated enough. She wants attention, but a man is too often distracted and unresponsive. The rake is a great female fantasy figure. When he desires a woman, brief though that moment may be, he will go to the ends of the earth for her. He may be disloyal, dishonest, and immoral, but that only adds to his appeal. Unlike the normal, cautious male, the rake is delightfully unrestrained, a slave to his love of women. There is the added lure of his reputation. So many women have succumbed to him, there has to be a reason. Words are a woman's weakness, and the rake is a master of seductive language. Stir a woman's repressed longings by adapting the rake's mix of danger and pleasure. The Ardent Rake. For the court of Louis XIV, the king's last years were gloomy. He was old and had become both insufferably religious and personally unpleasant. The court was bored and desperate for novelty. So in 1710, the arrival of a 15-year-old lad, who is both devilishly handsome and charming, had a particularly strong effect on the ladies. His name was Fronsac, the future Duke de Richelieu, his granduncle being the infamous Cardinal Richelieu. He was impudent and witty. The ladies would play with him like a toy, but he would kiss them on the lips in return, his hands wandering far for an inexperienced boy. When those hands strayed up the skirts of a duchess who was not so indulgent, the king was furious and sent the youth to the Bastille to teach him a lesson. But the ladies who had found him so amusing couldn't endure his absence. Compared to the stiffs in court, here was someone incredibly bold, his eyes boring into you, his hands quicker than was safe. Nothing could stop him. His novelty was irresistible. The court ladies pleaded, and his stay in the Bastille was cut short. Several years later, the young Mademoiselle de Valois was walking in a Paris park with her chaperone, an older woman, who never left her side. De Valois's father, the Duc d'Orléans, was determined to protect her, his youngest daughter, from all the court seducers until she could be married off. So he had attached to her this chaperone, a woman of impeccable virtue and sourness. In the park, however, de Valois saw a young man who gave her a look that set her heart on fire. He walked on by, but the look was intense and clear. It was her chaperone who told her his name, the now infamous Duc de Richelieu, blasphemer, seducer, heartbreaker. Someone to avoid at all cost. A few days later, the chaperone took de Valois to a different park, and lo and behold, Richelieu crossed their path again. This time he was in disguise, dressed as a beggar, but the look in his eye was unforgettable. Mademoiselle de Valois returned his gaze, at last something exciting in her drab life. Given her father's sternness, no man had dared approach her, and now this notorious courtier was pursuing her, instead of all the other ladies at court. What a thrill! Soon He was smuggling beautifully written notes to her, expressing his uncontrollable desire for her. She responded timidly, but soon the notes were all she was living for. In one of them, he promised to arrange everything if she would spend the night with him. Imagining it was impossible to bring such a thing to pass, she didn't mind playing along and agreeing to his bold proposal. Mademoiselle de Valois had a chambermaid named Angélique, who dressed her for bed and slept in an adjoining room. One night, as the chaperone was knitting, de Valois looked up from the book she was reading to see Angélique carrying her mistress's nightclothes to her room. But for some strange reason, Angélique looked back at her and smiled. It was Richelieu, expertly dressed as the maid. De Valois nearly gasped from fright, but caught herself, realizing the danger she was in. If she said anything, her family would find out about the notes and about her part in the whole affair. What could she do? She decided to go to her room and talk the young duke out of his ridiculously dangerous maneuver. She said good night to her chaperone, but once she was in her bedroom, the words she had planned were useless. When she tried to reason with Richelieu, he responded with that look in his eye, and then with his arms around her. She could not yell, but now she was unsure what to do. His impetuous words, his caresses, the danger of it all. Her head was whirling. She was lost. What was virtue and her prior boredom compared to an evening with the court's most notorious rake? So while the chaperone knitted away, the duke initiated her into the rituals of libertinage. Months later, de Valois's father had reason to suspect that Richelieu had broken through his lines of defense. The chaperone was fired. The precautions were doubled. D'Orléans did not realize that to Richelieu such measures were a challenge, and he lived for challenges. He bought the house next door under an assumed name and secretly tunneled a trapdoor through the wall adjoining the duke's kitchen cupboard. In this cupboard, over the next few months until the novelty wore off, de Valois and Richelieu enjoyed endless trysts. Everyone in Paris knew of Richelieu's exploits, for he made it a point to publicize them as loudly as possible. Every week, a new story would circulate through the court. A husband had locked his wife in an upstairs room at night, worried the duke was after her. To reach her, the duke had crawled in darkness along a thin wooden plank suspended between two upper floor windows. Two women, who lived in the same house, one a widow, the other married and quite religious, had discovered to their mutual horror that the duke was having an affair with both of them at the same time, leaving one in the middle of the night to be with the other. When they confronted him, the duke, always on the prowl for something novel, and a devilish talker, had neither apologized nor backed down, but proceeded to talk them into a ménage à trois, playing on the wounded vanity of each woman, who couldn't stand the thought of him preferring the other. Year after year, the stories of his remarkable seductions spread. One woman admired his audacity and bravery, another his gallantry in thwarting a husband. Women competed for his attention. If he didn't want to seduce you, there had to be something wrong with you. To be the target of his attentions became a great fantasy. At one point, two ladies fought a pistol duel over the duke, and one of them was seriously wounded. The Duchess d'Orléans, Richelieu's most bitter enemy, once wrote, "If I believed in sorcery, I should think that the duke possessed some supernatural secret, for I have never known a woman to oppose the very least resistance to him." In seduction, there is often a dilemma. To seduce, you need planning and calculation, but if your victim suspects that you have ulterior motives, she will grow defensive. Furthermore, if you seem to be in control, you will inspire fear instead of desire. The ardent rake solves this dilemma in the most artful manner. Of course, he must calculate and plan. He has to find a way around the jealous husband or whatever the obstacle is. It is exhausting work. But by nature, the ardent rake also has the advantage of an uncontrollable libido. When he pursues a woman, he really is aglow with desire. The victim senses this and is inflamed, even despite herself. How can she imagine that he is a heartless seducer who will abandon her when he so ardently braves all dangers and obstacles to get to her? And even if she is aware of his rakish past, of his incorrigible amorality, it doesn't matter, because she also sees his weakness. He cannot control himself. He actually is a slave to all women. As such, he inspires no fear. The ardent rake teaches us a simple lesson. Intense desire has a distracting power on a woman, just as the siren's physical presence does on a man. A woman is often defensive and can sense insincerity or calculation. But if she feels consumed by your attentions and is confident you will do anything for her, she will notice nothing else about you or will find a way to forgive your indiscretions. This is the perfect cover for a seducer. The key is to show no hesitation, to abandon all restraint, to let yourself go, to show that you cannot control yourself and are fundamentally weak. Don't worry about inspiring mistrust. As long as you are the slave to her charms, she will not think of the aftermath. The Demonic Rake. In the early 1880s, members of Roman high society began to talk of a young journalist who had arrived on the scene, a certain Gabriele D'Annunzio. This was strange in itself, for Italian royalty had only the deepest contempt for anyone outside their circle, and a newspaper society reporter was almost as low as you could go. Indeed, well-born men paid D'Annunzio little attention. He had no money and few connections, coming from a strictly middle-class background. Besides, to them, he was downright ugly. Short and stocky, with a dark, splotchy complexion and bulging eyes. The men thought him so unappealing, they gladly let him mingle with their wives and daughters, certain that their women would be safe with this gargoyle and happy to get this gossip hunter off their hands. No, it wasn't the men who talked of D'Annunzio. It was their wives. Introduced to D'Annunzio by their husbands, these duchesses and marchionesses would find themselves entertaining this strange-looking man, and when he was alone with them, his manner would suddenly change. Within minutes, these ladies would be spellbound. First, he had the most magnificent voice they had ever heard, soft and low, each syllable articulated, with a flowing rhythm and inflection that was almost musical. One woman compared it to the ringing of church bells in the distance. Others said his voice had a hypnotic effect. The words that voice spoke were interesting as well. Alliterative phrases, charming locutions, poetic images, and a way of offering praise that could melt a woman's heart. D'Annunzio had mastered the art of flattery. He seemed to know each woman's weakness. One he would call a goddess of nature, another an incomparable artist in the making, another a romantic figure out of a novel. A woman's heart would flutter as he described the effect she had on him. Everything was suggestive, hinting at sex or romance. That night, she would ponder his words, recalling little in particular that he'd said, because he never said anything concrete, but rather the feeling it had given her. The next day, she would receive from him a poem that seemed to have been written specifically for her. In fact, he wrote dozens of very similar poems, slightly tailoring each one for its intended victim. A few years after D'Annunzio began work as a society reporter, he married the daughter of the Duke and Duchess of Galese. Shortly thereafter, with the unshakable support of society ladies, he began publishing novels and books of poetry. The number of his conquests was remarkable, and also the quality. Not only marchionesses would fall at his feet, but great artists, such as the actress Eleonora Duza, who helped him become a respected dramatist and literary celebrity. The dancer Isadora Duncan, another who eventually fell under his spell, explained his magic. Perhaps the most remarkable lover of our time is Gabriele D'Annunzio, and this notwithstanding that he is small, bald, and except when his face lights up with enthusiasm, ugly. But when he speaks to a woman he likes, his face is transfigured, so that he suddenly becomes Apollo. His effect on women is remarkable. The lady he is talking to suddenly feels that her very soul and being are lifted. At the outbreak of World War I, the 52-year-old D'Annunzio joined the army. Although he had no military experience, he had a flair for the dramatic and a burning desire to prove his bravery. He learned to fly and led dangerous but highly effective missions. By the end of the war, he was Italy's most decorated hero. His exploits made him a beloved national figure, and after the war, crowds would gather outside his hotel, wherever in Italy he went. He would address them from a balcony, discussing politics, railing against the current Italian government. A witness of one of these speeches, the American writer Walter Starkey, was initially disappointed at the appearance of the famous D'Annunzio on a balcony in Venice. He was short and looked grotesque. Little by little, however, I began to sink under the fascination of the voice, which penetrated into my consciousness. Never a hurried, jerky gesture. He played upon the emotions of the crowd as a supreme violinist does upon a Stradivarius. The eyes of the thousands were fixed upon him as though hypnotized by his power. Once again, it was the sound of the voice and the poetic connotations of the words that seduced the masses. Arguing that modern Italy should reclaim the greatness of the Roman Empire, D'Annunzio would craft slogans for the audience to repeat, or would ask emotionally loaded questions for them to answer. He flattered the crowd, made them feel they were part of some drama. Everything was vague and suggestive. The issue of the day was the ownership of the city of Fiume, just across the border in neighboring Yugoslavia. Many Italians believed that Italy's reward for siding with the Allies in the recent war should be the annexation of Fiume. D'Annunzio championed this cause, and because of his status as a war hero, the army was ready to side with him, although the government opposed any action. In September of 1919, with soldiers rallying around him, D'Annunzio led his infamous march on Fiume. When an Italian general stopped him along the way and threatened to shoot him, D'Annunzio opened his coat to show his medals and said in his magnetic voice, "If you must kill me, fire first on this." The general stood there stunned, then broke into tears. He joined up with D'Annunzio. When D'Annunzio entered Fiume, he was greeted as a liberator. The next day, he was declared leader of the Free State of Fiume. Soon, he was giving daily speeches from a balcony overlooking the town's main square, holding tens of thousands of people spellbound without benefit of loudspeakers. He initiated all kinds of celebrations and rituals harking back to the Roman Empire. The citizens of Fiume began to imitate him, particularly his sexual exploits. The city became like a giant bordello. His popularity was so high that the Italian government feared a march on Rome, which at that point, had D'Annunzio decided to do it, and he had the support of a large part of the military, might actually have succeeded. D'Annunzio could have beaten Mussolini to the punch and changed the course of history. He was not a fascist, but a kind of aesthetic socialist. He decided to stay in Fiume, however, and ruled there for 16 months before the Italian government finally bombed him out of the city. Seduction is a psychological process that transcends gender, except in a few key areas where each gender has its own weakness. The male is traditionally vulnerable to the visual. The siren who can concoct the right physical appearance will seduce in large numbers. For women, the weakness is language and words. As was written by one of D'Annunzio's victims, the French actress Simone, "How can one explain his conquests except by his extraordinary verbal power and the musical timbre of his voice put to the service of exceptional eloquence? For my sex is susceptible to words, bewitched by them, longing to be dominated by them." The rake is as promiscuous with words as he is with women. He chooses words for their ability to suggest, insinuate, hypnotize, elevate, infect. The words of the rake are the equivalent of the bodily adornment of the siren, a powerful sensual distraction, a narcotic. The rake's use of language is demonic because it is designed not to communicate or convey information, but to persuade, flatter, stir emotional turmoil, much as the serpent in the Garden of Eden used words to lead Eve into temptation. The example of D'Annunzio reveals the link between the erotic rake, who seduces women, and the political rake, who seduces the masses. Both depend on words. Adapt the character of the rake, and you will find that the use of words as a subtle poison has infinite applications. Remember, it is the form that matters, not the content. The less your targets focus on what you say, and the more on how it makes them feel, the more seductive your effect. Give your words a lofty, spiritual, literary flavor, the better to insinuate desire in your unwitting victims. Keys to the character. At first, it may seem strange that a man who is clearly dishonest, disloyal, and has no interest in marriage would have any appeal to a woman. But throughout all of history and in all cultures, this type has had a fatal effect. What the rake offers is what society normally doesn't allow women: an affair of pure pleasure, an exciting brush with danger. A woman is often deeply oppressed by the role she is expected to play. She is supposed to be the tender, civilizing force in society, and to want commitment and lifelong loyalty. But often her marriages and relationships give her not romance and devotion, but routine and an endlessly distracted mate. It remains an abiding female fantasy to meet a man who gives totally of himself, who lives for her, even if only for a while. This dark, repressed side of female desire found expression in the legend of Don Juan. At first, the legend was a male fantasy, the adventurous knight who could have any woman he wanted. But in the 17th and 18th centuries, Don Juan slowly evolved from the masculine adventurer to a more feminized version, a man who lived only for women. This evolution came from women's interest in the story and was a result of their frustrated desires. Marriage, for them, was a form of indentured servitude. But Don Juan offered pleasure for its own sake, desire with no strings attached. For the time he crossed your path, you were all he thought about. His desire for you was so powerful that he gave you no time to think or to worry about the consequences. He would come in the night, give you an unforgettable moment, and then vanish. He might have conquered 1,000 women before you, but that only made him more interesting. Better to be abandoned than undesired by such a man. The great seducers do not offer the mild pleasures that society condones. They touch a person's unconscious, those repressed desires that cry out for liberation. Don't imagine that women are the tender creatures that some people would like them to be. Like men, they are deeply attracted to the forbidden, the dangerous, even the slightly evil. Don Juan ends by going to hell, and the word rake comes from rake hell, a man who rakes the coals of hell. The devilish component clearly is an important part of the fantasy. Always remember, if you are to play the rake, you must convey a sense of risk and darkness, suggesting to your victim that she is participating in something rare and thrilling, a chance to play out her own rakish desires. To play the rake, the most obvious requirement is the ability to let yourself go, to draw a woman into the kind of purely sensual moment in which past and future lose meaning. You must be able to abandon yourself to the moment. When the rake Valmont, a character modeled after the Duc de Richelieu in Laclos's 18th century novel Dangerous Liaisons, writes letters that are obviously calculated to have a certain effect on his chosen victim, Madame de Tourvel, she sees right through them. But when his letters really do burn with passion, she begins to relent. An added benefit of this quality is that it makes you seem unable to control yourself, a display of weakness that a woman enjoys. By abandoning yourself to the seduced, you make them feel that you exist for them alone, a feeling reflecting a truth, though a temporary one. Of the hundreds of women that Pablo Picasso, consummate rake, seduced over the years, most of them had the feeling that they were the only one he truly loved. The rake never worries about a woman's resistance to him, or for that matter, about any other obstacle in his path, a husband, a physical barrier. Resistance is only the spur to his desire, inflaming him all the more. When Picasso was seducing Françoise Gillot, in fact, he begged her to resist. He needed resistance to add to the thrill. In any case, an obstacle in your way gives you the opportunity to prove yourself, and the creativity you bring to matters of love. In the 11th century Japanese novel, The Tale of Genji, by the court lady Murasaki Shikibu, the rake, Prince Neo, is not disturbed by the sudden disappearance of Ukifune, the woman he loves. She has fled because although she is interested in the prince, she is in love with another man. But her absence allows the prince to go to extreme lengths to track her down. His sudden appearance to whisk her away to a house deep in the woods, and the gallantry he displays in doing so, overwhelm her. Remember, if no resistances or obstacles face you, you must create them. No seduction can proceed without them. The rake is an extreme personality. Impudent, sarcastic, and bitingly witty, he cares nothing for what anyone thinks. Paradoxically, this only makes him more seductive. In the court-like atmosphere of studio-era Hollywood, when most of the actors behaved like dutiful sheep, the great rake, Errol Flynn, stood out in his insolence. He defied the studio chiefs, engaged in the most extreme pranks, reveled in his reputation as Hollywood's supreme seducer, all of which enhanced his popularity. The rake needs a backdrop of convention, a stultified court, a humdrum marriage, a conservative culture, to shine, to be appreciated for the breath of fresh air he provides. Never worry about going too far. The rake's essence is that he goes further than anyone else. When the Earl of Rochester, 17th century England's most notorious rake and poet, abducted Elizabeth Mallet, one of the most sought-after young ladies of the court, he was duly punished. But lo and behold, a few years later, young Elizabeth, though wooed by the most eligible bachelors in the country, chose Rochester to be her husband. In demonstrating his audacious desire, he made himself stand out from the crowd. Related to the rake's extremism is the sense of danger, taboo, perhaps even the hint of cruelty about him. This was the appeal of another poet rake, one of the greatest in history, Lord Byron. Byron disliked any kind of convention and happily played this up. When he had an affair with his half-sister, who bore a child by him, he made sure that all of England knew about it. He could be uncommonly cruel, as he was to his wife, but all of this only made him that much more desirable. Danger and taboo appeal to a repressed side in women who are supposed to represent a civilizing, moralizing force in culture. Just as a man may fall victim to the siren through his desire to be free of his sense of masculine responsibility, a woman may succumb to the rake through her yearning to be free of the constraints of virtue and decency. Indeed, it is often the most virtuous woman who falls most deeply in love with the rake. Among the rake's most seductive qualities is his ability to make women want to reform him. How many thought they would be the one to tame Lord Byron? How many of Picasso's women thought they would finally be the one with whom he would spend the rest of his life? You must exploit this tendency to the fullest. When caught red-handed in rakishness, fall back on your weakness, your desire to change, and your inability to do so. With so many women at your feet, what can you do? You are the one who is the victim. You need help. Women will jump at this opportunity. They are uncommonly indulgent of the rake, for he is such a pleasant, dashing figure. The desire to reform him disguises the true nature of their desire, the secret thrill they get from him. When President Bill Clinton was clearly caught out as a rake, it was women who rushed to his defense, finding every possible excuse for him. The fact that the rake is so devoted to women, in his own strange way, makes him lovable and seductive to them. Finally, a rake's greatest asset is his reputation. Never downplay your bad name or seem to apologize for it. Instead, embrace it, enhance it. It is what draws women to you. There are several things you must be known for. Your irresistible attractiveness to women, your uncontrollable devotion to pleasure, this will make you seem weak, but also exciting to be around, your disdain for convention, a rebellious streak that makes you seem dangerous. This last element can be slightly hidden. On the surface, be polite and civil, while letting it be known that behind the scenes, you are incorrigible. The Duc de Richelieu made his conquests as public as possible, exciting other women's competitive desire to join the club of the seduced. It was by reputation that Lord Byron attracted his willing victims. A woman may feel ambivalent about President Clinton's reputation, but beneath that ambivalence is an underlying interest. Don't leave your reputation to chance or gossip. It is your life's artwork. You must craft it, hone it, and display it with the care of an artist. Dangers. Like the siren, the rake faces the most danger from members of his own sex, who are far less indulgent than women are of his constant skirt chasing. In the old days, a rake was often an aristocrat, and no matter how many people he offended or even killed, in the end, he would go unpunished. Today, only stars and the very wealthy can play the rake with impunity. The rest of us need to be careful. Elvis Presley had been a shy young man. Attaining early stardom and seeing the power it gave him over women, he went berserk, becoming a rake almost overnight. Like many rakes, Elvis had a predilection for women who were already taken. He found himself cornered by an angry husband or boyfriend on numerous occasions and came away with a few cuts and bruises. This might seem to suggest that you should step lightly around husbands and boyfriends, especially early on in your career. But the charm of the rake is that such dangers don't matter to them. You cannot be a rake by being fearful and prudent. The occasional pummeling is part of the game. Later on, in any case, at the height of Elvis's fame, no husband would dare touch him. The greater danger for the rake comes not from the violently offended husband, but from those insecure men who feel threatened by the Don Juan figure. Although they won't admit it, They envy the rake's life of pleasure, and like everyone envious, they will attack in hidden ways, often masking their persecutions as morality. The rake may find his career endangered by such men, or by the occasional woman who is equally insecure and who feels hurt because the rake does not want her.